recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 33 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast. Dave Musgrave here, joined by Dylan Hales. And this week we have as a guest British wrestling historian John Lister. John, how are you today?
I'm very well. Great to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great. People can check out some of John's work with Fighting Spirit magazine. He's also a publisher of two books, if you wanted to mention them as well.
Yeah, it's actually three books now. The first is Slamphology, which is a compilation of articles from sort of the first 15 years of my writing career. First half of the book is travelogues of various trips around the US, going to wrestling shows everywhere from the Channel 5 studios to the Sportatorium to the ECW arena. And then the second half of the book is various columns over the years. The second book is called Turning the Tables, and that's a complete history of the ECW promotion, looking both at the in-ring stuff and the behind-the-scenes sort of the business and the rise and fall there. And the last book is called Greetings, Grapple Fans. That's a Kindle exclusive, and that's a compilation of about 28 columns that I did for the Fight Network website in Canada, which is now offline, and those cover British wrestling past and present.
Excellent. Gives me something to buy for. That gives me something to buy myself for the holidays. I'll pick that one up for Christmas here in a couple of days. You said it was a Kindle exclusive, John?
That's right. Yeah, it's fairly short, so it wouldn't be really financially viable in print, but it's absolute bargain price on the Kindle, and sort of I think well worth looking at.
Excellent. Okay.
We wanted to have you on this week specifically with the timing being because there was a documentary on the past week called When Wrestling Was Golden, Grapples, Grunts, and Grannies on the BBC in reference to British wrestling history. So we thought that was good timing to have you on. So we're glad you're here. You were going to go ahead, Dylan, before I so rudely interrupted.
Yeah, well, I was literally about to say the exact same thing, but I was also going to say that I'm really excited to do this show because I think in the past, some of the shows we've done have been, you know, shows that focused on territories or even cities in wrestling, like the show we did with Pat LaPrade on Montreal. And this is a little bit even more expansive. And right out of the gate, I want to kind of throw something to John because – as, you know, I'm an American wrestling fan. Dave, obviously, is a Canadian wrestling fan. But, you know, we're North Americans. And I think the general perception that most North American wrestling fans have is that English wrestling, it's sort of, British wrestling, I should say, it's sort of just a monolith. Like, okay, it's something that happens over there. And it's all guys doing mat work that maybe is kind of unusual to Americans. Or it's guys like Big Daddy who are sort of your big, giant, sort of freakish figures bumping into each other. And I don't think – I don't want to say that North American fans are necessarily narrow-minded anymore because I think the Internet and the access to footage has sort of opened things up a little bit. But I do think there is still a tendency with a lot of North American fans to sort of view British wrestling as a sort of novelty and totally – Maybe a very, I would say, just on the surface level, sort of a short-sighted view of British wrestling. And I wonder if what John would think about that perception. And also, and this is a broad question, grant me that early. How do you think? Do you think that sort of perception that American fans have is fair? And if not, how would you describe, the more subtle differences between British wrestling and what a North American wrestling fan might identify as a common pro wrestling match?
Well, I think the two main differences when you're looking at from sort of a North American perspective, where you've got the different territories, but they all had maybe a different style, often based on what the local promoter liked and what the local fans went into. But the general kind of business model was the same. You had your TV show with your squash matches most of the time, building up to your live events at the gates that were running maybe weekly or monthly. Over in Britain, the TV was very different because the whole time it was on television, the TV was actually produced by ITV, the television company itself, by their sports department, who covered it in exactly the same way as they would any other sport. They sent the same crew out, turned up and filmed it and put it on the air. So the promoters who were actually putting these matches on had, there was no way of doing sort of direct promos for particular shows. There were very little interviews of any kind, and they sort of kind of the direct soap opera of the week-to-week episodic kind of thing. The other big difference was the business model, which was, rather than, you know, Britain wasn't a territory where you had maybe four or five big cities that you'd visit every week on sort of a weekly loop. It had, in January 1963, we recently sort of looked through the schedules there because it's almost exactly 50 years ago. In the first week of January alone, in England, there were 82 shows run by joint promotions, not including the independent ones. Of those, you had 35 towns who were having wrestling every week. So it was very much a case of having many, many different stars you could draw, running in sort of venues of between maybe as small as 500, some of them as big as 5,000 that were running weekly. So you had to have a lot of stars, and you were making a sort of a small amount of money from each show, adding up to a huge amount for the promoters overall.
Yeah, and I think that's hard for a lot of fans to grasp. I think when you the business model, I think, is very difficult, even for, you know, I guess would be commonly characterized as smart wrestling fans to grasp, is how could it be that these guys were making money when they weren't running, you know, 15,000 seat buildings? Because we have a very, I mean, Americans especially are obsessed with bigness to begin with. So I think there's sort of this idea that if something's not unbelievably grandiose in scope, it can't really be successful. And I always sort of compare it, and this really isn't a fair comparison because, I mean, we're talking about a whole country here, but I always sort of compare it to Portland, which obviously is something that is close to my heart, in the sense that Don Owen owned his own building, ran his own promotion out of the building that he owned, made tons of money off of it because he had, you know, didn't have to pay out for security and things like that. And on top of that, he ran his own concessions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of his buildings that he ran were relatively small. But by all accounts, Portland was a successful wrestling territory for 70-plus years, and really one of the longest-lasting, I should say, wrestling promotions in the United States. And while it's obviously not exactly the same thing, I think there's sort of a comparison to be made there in the sense that it shows you that things that, you know, not every promotion had to be a place that could run Madison Square Garden and sell it out every week. It was definitely a different model. And even as I say this, it's even myself, I find it kind of hard to grasp that you had these promoters who were running, you know, thousands of shows a year over the entire island. I mean, it's literally hard for me to understand, even as somebody who's probably studied it more than the average fan, I would guess. Now, joint promotions was effectively the British version of the NWA, for lack of a better term. Is that a fair assessment, or would that be off mark somehow?
Yeah, it was a very similar idea. It was a promotional cartel of sort of main promoters. You had a lot more independent promotions over here who sort of weren't part of that, who didn't have the access to the television. So they would often produce either sort of kind of older stars or maybe sort of a more violent or a different kind of ring style. But there's this very strange relationship between joint and independent promoters, which is kind of, if you're an independent person and you're promoting in sort of the smaller venues in smaller towns that joint promotions aren't running, which seems crazy when you're running 80 shows a week, though there could be anywhere else left in the country, but there were sort of lots of smaller towns. If you ran there, sort of kept your place, you were fine. If you went into joint territory and tried to run the same venues as then or venues in the same town, it became sort of very nasty promotional war kind of thing. So that's kind of how it fit together. But one thing with the talking about the sort of the size of the venues and the fact that they're running lots of small venues rather than big ones was not really through choice. It was partly through circumstances, because you often hear when people are analysing drawing power, the sort of figure of how many 10,000 seater venues did you sell out. For pretty much the whole time that the British wrestling was on television, there were effectively no 10,000-seater venues in Britain because most of those kind of venues in the States were sports venues, things like basketball, hockey, that kind of thing. In the UK, all the most popular sports, the kind of football, cricket, rugby, are all outdoor stadiums of sort of 40 or 50,000 in most cities, which clearly you're not going to be running less than any kind of regular basis.
That makes
and
sense.
And most of this time, there was pretty much only Wembley Arena was the only 10,000-plus seat building, which the British wrestling promotions ran three times in the late 70s and early 80s. But even that, that was not the kind of venue that people went to regularly. It was primarily a concert and sort of live events venue of that kind. So it was something you would go to as a special treat. And people really didn't travel to their local entertainment because they didn't need to, because there was always something on your doorstep. There were sort of all these venues that were right there. I used to live very near the Bellevue venue in Manchester, which was a sort of wrestling hotbed back in the day. And that actually wouldn't have been my local venue. There would have been two or three other venues that I could have got to on foot just from my home. And had I been that day, you very easily could have gone to between five and seven shows in Manchester alone, but one city. So there would be no need to travel. So you wouldn't have fans coming sort of an hour, 2 hours, as would often happen in the United States, which is one of the reasons you didn't kind of have to have this model where you'd be gathering large crowds together.
Yeah, I read the sort of time capsule that you wrote of British wrestling history, which is a really good article that it's available on the web. It's about 10 years old, I think, but it's out there. And
on the House of Deception website, that one?
Yes.
Yeah, I read that last night.
And I think you sort of in there you made the analogy that in a lot of ways it's comparable to Mexico City, where you had to this huge market where you could we know the stories about Mexico City where there's oftentimes tons of shows going on the same day. So what you're describing to me really is not that different from that, I don't guess. It's a big market for wrestling, like you said. It was local because of the local access and these local halls. You really didn't have to leave go very far to see quality wrestling. One thing I want to throw out real quick too. While we're on this subject, then I want to come back and I want to get Dave to kind of comment on his thoughts on the documentary, and then we'll go back to you on your thoughts on it, John. But I just want to throw this out there now because I don't want to forget it. One of the things that always fascinated me watching British wrestling is, and I love it. Some of my favorite all-time performers, particularly Jim Breaks, who's probably literally one of my 10 favorite wrestlers ever lived. But it fascinates me that, like you said, these guys weren't even on TV very often. A lot of the best guys who were excellent hands and very good and very talented wrestlers and performers, they didn't work on TV that often because of the nature of the TV. And I'm always so impressed by Kent Walton, because here you've got a guy who basically he had to get over every single guy who was on television as somebody who would be worth going down to your local hall to see wrestle. Because you never knew who you were going to see every week. You might see Terry Rudd, you might see Pat Roach, you might see Jim Briggs, you might see somebody that you'd never really seen before. And you never, it amazes me. Kent Walton was so good at getting all these guys over. Is this just my perception? Because to me, Kent Walton, just in the way he was able to use his skills as an announcer of the World of Sport television show, had to have been a very valuable asset to joint promotions, or really to British wrestling in general, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I was sort of very much in favour of him getting into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame last year. When we talk about people who are not on television that much, sort of even the big stars would be on between 6 and 12 times a year, and that was, in some cases considered overexposure. And that's simply the fact, because of the business model, you have between 400 and 500 regular active wrestlers in the country who are wrestling, several times a week at least, if not working as a full-time. Going into between two and one slots each week, depending on what time you're talking about, of around an hour, which had maybe sort of two or three matches. So it was really, the television was kind of making these people into stars rather than setting up specific matches, which was done more at the local shows, which were running regularly and would have the feuds and the storylines. But Kent Walton match, absolutely, because he was having to commentate from the sports perspective, as if he was sort of a sports announcer, but at the same time was kind of putting people over. And he had a very good skill, which is kind of the Jim Ross does it at times, which is that he would kind of with a wink and nod when you had a guy who was not particularly going to ring, sort of a disappointing match, would without outright sort of attacking it, would not try and put it over as a fantastic match. So that on the times when he did put somebody over, particularly if you had maybe a new younger wrestler coming in, like a Davey Boy Smith or a Dynamite, who was starting up sort of in their teens on national television, when he did praise them, that meant a lot more.
Yeah, I agree with that. I wanted to get that out of the way now, because I did not want to forget that later when we start talking about some of these individual guys and other things. I'm a huge Kent Walton fan, and I mean, last night I rewatched Jim Breaks versus Steve Gray from February of 1980, which is probably one of my favorite matches of all time. Johnny Saint versus Steve Gray, rather. And Walton, when Walton marks out for something on commentary, you know it's good.
You know? I think his style, I sort of compare very much to a Lance Russell, where you wouldn't necessarily argue that him or Russell were the best announcers ever, but they were both absolutely the best at in their particular context, in their style, in their setting, were completely right for it. And it's kind of very hard to imagine anybody else in sort of the same position.
Yeah, I totally agree. Anyway, Dave, I wanted to go to you because I wanted to get your thoughts on the documentary that was on that we both, all of us, have watched. And then we'll kind of pitch to John for his thoughts, too. But, Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it, and I would liken it to the unreal story of professional wrestling. When I watched that in the 90s, I felt I learned a lot from it. But what I did last night is I watched that, and then I went and read John's article on the House of Deception and learned what I would assume is probably a more accurate telling of some of this stuff. I really didn't understand the kind of structure of joint promotions until I watched the documentary, and then I got it fleshed out more with John's writing. But yeah, it very much is like the old NWA, and I would say the World of Sports show is basically like if the NWA had one showcase show, and that's basically what the World of Sports show was, instead of a reflection of weekly in and out stuff, right? One of the things I really thought with the show is that it really came off as basically telling the story from the perspective of people who are still alive or willing to speak. And as I mentioned to you, Dylan, I really think that, you know, Bert Aserati, even if he is an overrated historical figure, probably is more relevant than Klondike Kate in the narrative. But, you know, she was willing to speak, and I'm sure she was an entertaining character in the show as well. So I would have liked to have heard more about guys like Bert Aserati, or of course I would have liked to have heard about Gordienko, or especially, and what I would have liked to have heard some about is some of that era from in between George Hackenschmidt and Mick McManus. So, but it was only an hour, so that didn't help.
Yeah, I was kind of impressed that they even covered the era, you know, at all between the music hall era, I guess is what you'd call it, maybe, if that's the right term. John could feel free to correct me. I guess
it's probably most fair to identify it as something I'm interested in rather than criticizing it for not being in there. So
yeah, I was actually impressed that they covered that transition period at all, though, because usually when you see these historical documentaries, even on anything that's sports related or entertainment related, there's big gaps. Usually they just cover sort of like the high points, and there's no real discussion at all of anything that happened in the valleys. And while there wasn't a huge discussion of anything that happened in the valleys, I thought they did a pretty good job of sort of bridging the gap between you know, the music hall era again, which may be a totally wrong way of putting it, and the era of, you know, where wrestling was sort of blacklisted, I guess, so to speak, as an institution in the UK or Britain, and then, you know, wrapping it back around and getting back to the reinstitution and the creation of joint promotions and sort of the cartelization of wrestling as a way of saving it. I thought it was done quickly and succinctly, but I really enjoyed it. Anyway, John, what were your thoughts on it? I actually thought it was it was character-driven, but I thought for a character-driven documentary that was given an hour, it was fairly good.
I think in terms of covering the big picture and sort of an accurate representation of kind of the timeline history, it's by far the best thing I've ever seen sort of a mainstream publicity. I mean, it's the first mainstream coverage of sort of British wrestling I've ever seen that's mentioned Norman Morell, who is probably the most important sort of non-wrestling figure in British history. He was one of the key guys behind joint promotions. He was a trainer of a lot of guys. He was a former wrestler himself, and an amateur wrestler as well. And he was also sort of key with doing this Mount Evans report, which is kind of amazing to look back on, which is that they actually managed to get Apple Lord Mount Evans, who was kind of a senior figure in kind of sort of the British society, along with a couple of people off a sort of radio panel discussion, and actually had a parliamentary committee. So this is a bit like if you had a Senate committee to sort of look into ways of cleaning up and promoting the wrestling business. So you have all this, what this Admiral Lord Mount Evans, what he was doing, nobody really knows, because he was pretty much used to just give this amazing authority to the relaunch of the business. Came up with a kind of new set of rules for it, which made it look like much more of a sport, which absolutely paved the way for them to go onto television and get it televised as if it was a regular sport like anything else.
Yeah, I thought that's kind of what I meant by covering those valleys. I thought that was, you know, it was succinct, but it was better than I expected, you know, because usually with your wrestling documentaries, you get all your high points covered, and there's really no attempt to bridge from point A to point B. It's here's this big figure, here's this big figure, here's this big figure, the end. That's sort of how it works. And, you know, for an hour-long documentary, you know, I thought it was pretty good. And, of course, I think the real high point for some of us, for me certainly, and I think maybe even for John too, although I don't want to speak for him, was that we got some of the clips from the famous McManus-Jackie Paolo match. I mean, that in some ways was the high point of the whole thing.
That's certainly something you never expected to see on television again. You'd heard rumours that footage of it existed, and it was actually first brought out by a couple of former wrestlers themselves, a guy called Steve Hughey, I think, and a Tarzan boy, Darren, and a friend of theirs. And it turns out that there's a whole room in one of the former sort of ITV network stations full of reels of old film, which just say wrestling on, they're not labelled. And they charge you something like $1,000 to go into the room and just watch the tapes to find out what's on them. And this guy who took the McManus Palo footage away, they charged him something like $300-$350 just to get a copy of it put onto disc. And that's with no sort of reproduction rights. It was just to take it home for personal use. And it was actually shown at one of the wrestler-only reunions a couple of years ago. And that's the same footage which the BBC went to the archives and got hold of. So to actually see that on television in sort of very good quality was kind of something you never expect to see. And certainly from the clips that showed up, it really did hold up, and you could see that this the McManus Palo match was very clearly worked as a grudge match, and sort of shown with a kind of a aggression which you didn't really associate with the particularly on-screen TV products, because the TV was much more kind of a straight, clean, sporting thing than a lot of the live events, which were, you'd have a lot more blood, sort of violent, more kind of angry grudge matches built up there.
Yeah, I was really impressed by the footage that was, I mean, it was not your sort of stereotypical guys just laying around doing nothing, which is what you always hear about from that. You know, that's sort of like what, you know, I mean, this is not a knock at Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe, which will people will read this that way, but whatever. But it wasn't your Dory Funk Jr. Jack Briscoe style affair either, where you have, you know, sort of a cerebral chess game where they're building to these, you know, like a suplex for 15 minutes. I mean, granted, we didn't see the whole arc, but my point is, you could tell these guys were working really, really hard, and it definitely did have a grudge match feel. You know, I mean, we'll likely never see the... Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
It was very heated, for sure.
Yes, yeah. And, I mean, we're likely never going to see the full thing, but just being able to see those clips is pretty awesome, and much better than I think any of us ever would have expected, even as recently as earlier this year. You know, I was really, really pleased by that aspect. And you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say it. Another thing I really enjoyed about the documentary, I like the Kendo Nagasaki stuff. I like the fact that ridiculously carny aspect of the sport was played up on a legitimate documentary like that. I know some people thought it was terrible. I really enjoyed it. I think the
one thing you can guarantee, you know, you may have said up to this year, we're never going to see McManus Palo on television. I can guarantee you will never see an RF video face-off series where The Undertaker and Kendo Nagasaki sit next to each other and sort of do a shooting interview. And I would pay to see that.
I think that's a safe assumption. I really enjoyed that. I mean, it was totally silly, but I really did like it. I liked a lot of it. I thought it was overall a really good effort, especially because they only had an hour. I mean, I thought the Adrian Street stuff was really interesting.
That's what I was going to say. His part was really strong too.
Yeah. In fact, let me ask John about Adrian Street a little bit, because and we're skipping around a little bit here, and I've got some other people I want to get back to get your thoughts on, go back to. But Adrian Street is a guy who, I mean, I know he was over there. His 1972 TV match with Jim Breaks is another one of my all-time favorite matches. But I always wonder how big of a star was Street relative to some of these other... I mean, obviously he wasn't McManus. Nobody's suggesting that. But was he, you know, like the next tier down of guys after McManus and Paulo? Or would he have been like, you know, a guy that got his shots on TV here or there like everybody else, but wasn't a particularly important or unique star in the British landscape?
You'd probably say he was more of a memorable TV star than an absolute top level star. He was as big as the kind of guys who are kind of regularly featured on TV. So he was certainly big enough he could main event a show in places without any trouble. You wouldn't necessarily say he was, you know, among kind of, you know, the top star of the decade or anything like that.
No. And in fact, since you brought it up, top stars of the decade is actually a worthwhile question, because as people who listen to this podcast know, Dave and myself have a tendency to ramble about both historical figures and, of course, obviously the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, among other things. And, you know, I mean, candidates from Europe in general, let alone Britain, although that's probably the biggest subset. But, you know, they're kind of always sort of looked at as sort of, okay, how do you evaluate these guys? Who was really that biggest star? For a variety of things we've already talked about, size, you know, drawing power and how you analyze it. And then you've got the issue of guys that weren't on TV all that much. And when I was reading, the Mick McManus bio for the Observer Hall of Fame, which I believe you wrote, John. But
that's right.
When I was reading it, one thing that really stood out to me is that, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't want to quote you wrong, but you said Jim Breaks was a guy who was on TV more than almost anybody else. And my question is, guys like Jim Brakes, Johnny Saint, Steve Gray, Clive, my sort of the names that maybe your hardcore tape trader fans would know in the United States. Of those guys, which ones were really the biggest stars? Because the impression to me is that Brakes and Saint from that era would be at the top of the list.
Then there would be maybe
a small climb down to guys like, say, a Steve Gray and others. But I don't know if that's true. As an American, I don't know if that's true. So set me straight.
Definitely, Brakes and Saint, just partly from longevity, and they were certainly the kind of guys who, even though were lightweights and welterweights, could absolutely headline a show on their own, or you could have a major show at like a place like the Royal Albert Hall, which is sort of the closest thing to the bigger show of the month, and they could very easily be in a headline match or sort of a top supporting match there. Because at any time you really needed in the business, you know, somewhere between 20 and 40 kind of guys who were at least capable of headline being the TV star on a local show, and they were certainly very much in that that kind of level.
Yeah, and Brakes to me, like, of all the guys from that era that I've seen quite a few. I'm sure not as much as you, and not as much as probably some people listening to this, but Brakes to me is the guy who I always look at and think, this guy could have been a huge star in the United States. Like, I, it's not to say other guys couldn't have. And in fact, you know, some guys who were around, you know, came around in the late 70s, early 80s, did become big stars in the United States. But Brakes to me was a guy who really, really could have been huge here. I mean, he had the facial expressions you would expect. He was sort of... he was a nasty, gritty heel and, of course, infamously a crybaby, too, at the same time. And to me, he comes across, when you watch him, as a TV star. He comes across as a guy that is made for television.
I think you should mention that, actually, because I mean, obviously, you know, seeing all the matches and seeing, you know, great character and great in-ring performer. But something I recently came across was a... TV drama program from the late 70s, early 80s called Send In The Girls, which was, it was about a local group of girls who went around as doing kind of promotional events. So each week would be set in a different place. And the first episode was written by Brian Glover, who was wrestled as Leon Harris, and it was set at a wrestling show. And Jim Brakes is wrestling on the show that this takes place at, and he's kind of a background character, so he doesn't have any major speaking role. He's in the background in a few scenes. And he just absolutely steals the show, not doing anything, just sort of sitting there, being himself, sitting in the background in the bar afterwards, because he's just the kind of character that every pub in Britain, you've got a Jim Brakes in it, this kind of little guy, he's an annoying guy. You'd like... You know, at times you'd like to punch him, and you know he'd probably, you know, he's kind of sitting there and being a bit annoying, being a bit joking. But you know, if things turn nasty, he'd really turn off. He's kind of like the description in the BBC documentary about McManus, of how he's a pup fighter tough. He's not a bodybuilder or sort of an athlete tough. And that you know, he wouldn't necessarily have the strength to overcome you, but he wouldn't mind going for your eye or, you know, ripping your nose or something.
Yeah, Brakes to me always... I wrote something about him years ago on a message board somewhere, and it was just a general observation, but Brakes to me always comes across as that guy who is the legitimate good athlete, but he's the cocky athlete that's not as good as he thinks he is. He's the guy in a soccer game, or excuse me, I should say football, because I am on the line with John. But he's the guy in a football game who's very, very skilled with the ball, but would rather dribble around the field than even dream of taking a pass. And I just absolutely love him. I mean, he's one of my absolute favorites. And last night I rewatched Jim Brakes versus Young David, which is Davey Boy Smith when he was very, very young, a teenager. And there's a match from 1980. They've got a match from 79 that's on tape, too, that's maybe even better. But this match it's really an incredible match. And it's out there. It's available on YouTube for people who want to watch it. But it's really an incredible match because Davey is so young. and I think he's 17 at the time. And breaks, I mean, Davey's a good athlete then. This is not an attack on Davey at all. He was very athletic and very sharp for his age, but breaks really leads him through this incredible match. And it's this slow building match that just a 12 rounder. It builds really, really slow. And as the match goes on, you get to more and more of these classic Jim Breaks facial expressions. You get, you know, his taunting and screaming, his cheap shots in between every round. He feels the need to step on somebody's arm to set up the Jim Breaks special later on or whatever. I mean, he's really a great performer. There may be a lot of people who listen to this who've never seen Jim Breaks. He's a guy, you know, Johnny Saint's gotten a lot of exposure in recent years in the United States. Jim Breaks is a guy who I would really, 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 really think that a lot of American wrestling fans would probably enjoy a lot. So,
what I've seen of him that people can look up to attack both angles on that is some of the I saw Jim Breaks Johnny Saint matches, which were fantastic.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think they're both incredible wrestlers in their own way. And I think Saint, similarly to Breaks in some ways, was also made to be a TV star because of his flashy style. He didn't have anything near the charisma of Breaks, in my opinion. But he has the style that I think a lot of American wrestling fans, particularly people, you know, that have been exposed to him through Chikara and his other appearances and things like that, would probably identify as the British style. I think it's a little bit too stereotypical, but I think Saint's probably the guy they would identify that way. And I want to ask John about this, because I know Johnny Saint, or at least Kent Walton, would always talk about George Kidd when Johnny Saint was on TV. It was like always an excuse to talk about George Kidd, or a lot of times it was anyway. And George Kidd, I believe, was a Scottish wrestler, and I don't think there's very much, if any, George Kidd. I don't think I've ever seen a George Kidd match. But a lot of people say he was sort of the originator of the style that would become best known under people like Johnny Saint and Clive Myers and Steve Gray years later. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, that's certainly right. I mean, George Kidd was absolutely Kent Walton's favorite wrestler, which is, I think, one of the reasons that he kind of used it to build up Johnny Saint as much. And Johnny Saint has actually said that, you know, the suggestion of George Kidd being kind of his training and mentor is overblown, to say the least. And the only footage that sort of survives of Kidd is, I think it's about a 5-minute match, and he's getting very much on there. So you kind of only really sort of see a flash of what he's doing. But you did have this kind of diversity of stars because of having the weight divisions right through from your heavyweight down to the lightweight. So you would be able to have kind of a very mixed bill when you went to a show. So you would have the kind of match with the kind of the lightweights doing the fast-paced stuff. You'd have the heavyweight clash. And then a lot of time the lightweights and the welterweight kind of match would be done very clean, which would then set up when the villains and the heels cheated in the next match. It kind of stood out a lot more, which is a similar kind of thing that was done to certainly done in Florida and even in the United States, where the poor people there had to sit through a 20-minute draw with two sort of lower card Johnny Rods kind of guys every time, which I think was kind of, I'd rather watch the kind of the British lightweight match would be a better way of kind of setting up the table for the people to follow on later on. But it's kind of interesting you're talking about the Young David Jim Breaks match, because one of those sort of two famous matches is a great example of the round system, which I think may confuse a lot of sort of non-British fans for the first time they see it, where most matches, particularly in the TV era, were wrestled over a certain number of rounds, just like a UFC or a boxing match, but they were best two out of three falls or submissions. But if you got a knockout, you won the match straight away, which was obviously works great as a dramatic device and also made a lot of sense, because if you are knocked out, it makes no sense that you can carry on wrestling the match. And you're able to put together sort of quite interesting scenarios like the Davey Boy Breaks match, where I believe David Boy was one fall down with one round left in the match, and he's kind of then left with a decision as, does he kind of go all out and try and win with the knockout and win the whole match, or does he try and play it safe, try to get the fall and sort of get a draw, which for a guy in his position,
yeah,
a guy challenging the champions, is a great win.
I think the breaks young Davey match is a really good introductory match to people.
Round system, the impression I get from talking to sort of older wrestlers is it was kind of very useful for the wrestlers as well, because it meant you didn't have to go and choreograph an entire match and, you know, plan it all move for move, which wasn't really kind of fitting with the way the British wrestlers worked. But it did mean you could kind of have a loose structure of, you know, in the second fall, I'm going to take the first fall. You know, maybe in the third fall, I'll injure your arm. You'll make a comeback in the fourth. So you can just kind of go out there with just enough sort of bullet points that you've got the kind of the drama of the match. But at the same time, you've got plenty of leeway to kind of improvise and wing it while you're out there and read the crowd.
Yeah, I think the round system is hard to get used to for all of maybe the first three rounds. But if you're watching a good enough match, you pretty quickly can see why the workers would see it as an advantage, I think. Because it does allow for a different approach to wrestling psychology, I think. You know, you can do a lot of the same things, but you can do them in different and unique ways. I watched Terry Rudge versus Marty Jones also last night, which is another match I really like a lot. And, you know, it was a catchweight match. Terry Rudge is a much bigger heavyweight than Marty Jones was. And, you know, the round system sort of allowed them to do a slower burn on your baby faces get frustrated with each other and then eventually get rough narrative that we often see in face versus face matches. And I mean, it was just really well done. It's not something I think you could have executed as well or as interestingly if there wasn't rounds. I think American fans maybe see rounds as a handicap, but I don't really necessarily think they are. I mean, I think they could be, I guess, if the wrong two guys were in the ring, but they're not necessarily a handicap, and they can actually add intrigue to a match if it's put together the right way. Certainly, in this instance with Young Davey and Jim Breaks, I think it absolutely was put together the right way. But I guess I want to ask you about another person or a wrestler who you have more general thoughts on. You know, I think one of the more successful, one of the figures that American wrestling fans would see as more successful outside of Britain would be Mark Rocco, because he had his run in New Japan where he was worked at Black Tiger and was sort of a known junior heavyweight during a period where junior heavyweight wrestling was really taking off. I've heard people say that Mark Rocco was a very reliable drawing card for joint promotions at times. Obviously, the general perception of him is that he was a very strong hand in the ring. Is it fair to characterize Mark Rocco as somebody who would be on that Break Saint level, or would he be maybe a peg down relative to them?
Oh no, I would definitely say he was on their level at all. I mean, he in terms of kind of drawing power and importance, he was the key guy who was taken over when Brian Dixon started joint promotion, All Star Promotions, which was the most successful of the independent groups, was on TV at times in the last couple of years before wrestling was taken off, and is in fact still running this day. And so, in fact, somebody's recently calculated that around about September, October time next year, he will have been running longer than joint promotions did and will become the longest running promotion in British history. And probably maybe third or fourth after all, behind only sort of All Japan, New Japan, and CMLL. So he'd been running for over 40 years. But Mark Rocco was actually absolutely key. He was he sort of what main attraction, and he was somebody who he wrestled a heavyweight style at a middleweight pace. He really was particularly coming along in the Daddy era, was sort of so fast-paced, so aggressive. And that's even, you know, within the confines of wrestling and ITV, where there were kind of limits on the kind of violent stuff you could do, how much blood you could have. There's a great match out there on YouTube with Mark Rocco and Kung Fu, which was done an independent show shown on cable television here in the 80s. And it pretty much looks as if they sat down for the show and thought, let's put together a list of everything we're not allowed to do on television for ITV, and we're going to go out and do it out there. So you've got swearing, you've got some blood, I think, you've got brawling out in the crowd, you've got chair shots, you've got people being choked with a microphone cable, you've got the announcers slammed on the floor afterwards, and it's just absolutely amazing to watch that when you've been watching kind of a world of sports star. That was the kind of style that they were doing at the live events.
Yeah, that's really great. I've actually not seen that match, so I really want to see that now. But, you know, Rocco, I just thought he's worth mentioning because, you know, he's another guy. And I think most people who do think of Mark Rocco would associate him almost immediately with the Dynamite Kid because him and Dynamite had at least a few televised matches that were quite good. Of course, they both went into the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Division right around the same time. The impression I've always gotten is that Rocco could have been, you know, just as big as Kid internationally if maybe just a few things had gone slightly different, or maybe he just didn't even want to leave where he was. I don't know the details. But Rocco was certainly a guy who could have been at that level. Transitioning, I guess, a little bit. Obviously, Dynamite Kid is a guy who I think gets credited along maybe with Rocco simultaneously, maybe in unison, as being guys who sort of sped up the style of world of sport, for lack of a better term. Maybe that's not even a fair way of putting it, but I know when I watch those two, it feels like you've hit the you've hit the fast forward button relative to the other stuff that's going on. And I love a lot of the other stuff. That's in no way a criticism of the other matches. In fact, frankly, I like most of the other matches I've mentioned better than I like the Dynamite Rocco matches. But it feels like the style was a picked up pace of that British style. Do you think Dynamite was an influential figure in the UK in British wrestling, or do you think he was a guy whose influence was felt more in North America and Japan and elsewhere?
I think arguably more overseas, because what a lot of people don't realize is that Dynamite Kid was only actually full-time in Britain for maybe a few years before he was over in Canada and Japan, as opposed to a lot of people who tend to have much longer careers. But certainly he was the kind of guy who once he went overseas, you'd be able to sort of point to him as, you know, some kind of as a kind of an export of the British system, which I think brought a lot more kind of interest from overseas into British wrestlers. But the UK was at the same time, you kind of had a sort of informal partnership with Stampede, where a lot of guys went back and forth there. So we had Brett and Owen Hart, both came over here in their early years. And it was also for many years was a kind of a training ground for the New Japan as well. Where once you had a New Japan guy who was kind of a rookie there, he'd been in Japan for about a year or so at the bottom of the card, he'd be sent off on his world tour. So he'd go to Stampede, he'd go and do the tournaments in Germany, and then he'd spend his time maybe a year or so in Britain learning the song. Everybody from kind of Tiger Masks, Funaki, Akira Maeda has worked over here, right through to the likes of Hiro Yamamoto and Satoshi Kojima. I think I'm probably one of the few people in the world who've seen Satoshi Kojima lose a match to a Mighty Morphin Wrestling Power Ranger.
Yes, you may be a very short list of people who can lay claim to that. This is skipping way ahead, and I want to go back because I want you to expand a little bit on guys like Jackie Paolo and McManus here in a minute. But one other thing that about the documentary that I really kind of I don't even know that I enjoyed it so much as I was happy to see it is, I'm a really big fan of James Mason, and in terms of the modern scene, I think he's an extremely underrated and underutilized talent. In my mind, he's one of the better workers, really, in wrestling, period, anywhere. And I was really happy to see him get TV time in that documentary. Even if it was just explaining basic holds for split seconds in the ring, I thought it was really neat that he got spotlight time on BBC television, and that people will at least see him for 2 seconds in this documentary or however long he was on the screen. Because,
as a modern representative, yeah.
Yeah, and of modern guys, he's an outstanding performer. And I believe he works for All Star some, and some of the other independent groups that are still open. He had an excellent series of matches last year with Dean Allmark that is maybe my favorite series of the entire year, or close to it. And I wanted to ask John, are there any other guys on the modern British scene who you think American fans should track down or seek out? Because James Mason, I think, is excellent. I would tell everybody, go YouTube every possible match of James Mason. But is there anybody else that you think really stands out of the pack?
I think in terms of the traditional British star, you'll see a guy called Mikey Whiplash, who also works for All-Star along with Dean Allmark. But you have, at the moment, the British scene, you have so many kind of different styles. You have a lot of promotions who are sort of based in one town, one, and will run one venue regularly every month. And then there's the bigger promotions like LDN and All-Star, who are still kind of touring, going to venues as a one-off. But there's kind of a promotion for every star. There's a group called Lucha Britannia who do kind of a combination of Lucha Libre and burlesque. And then there's a promotion in Scotland called ICW that is doing kind of the ECW thing in terms of, you know, their crowd are pretty much entirely drunk throughout the entire things. You've got the Bucky Boys who are kind of local. I realise none of these things are going to mean anything. They're kind of local Neds or Chavs, which means they're kind of local kids, kind of working class troublemakers. And the Bucky Boys is a reference to Buckfast wine, which is a kind of very high alcohol sort of drink, which seems to be very popular in sort of rundown areas of Glasgow, and you know, gets you absolutely hammered very quickly. So they're sort of real characters there. So you really have, you've got something for every star, and it's so much easier these days to kind of see them online and see what's going on. Actually, one that's just come to mind that you would really fits for the beautiful question you've done is a guy called Jack Gallagher, who wrestles promotions including Future Shock Wrestling, Grand Pro Wrestling. He's done some matches for sort of Preston City Wrestling. So I mean, if you look for him, he was a guy, I think I probably saw him very early in his career when he was sort of in his late teens. He was called Jack Toxic at the time. He had like spiky ginger hair, you know, oversized pleather pants, and he kind of reinvented himself a few years ago. He's kind of hit the gym. He's gone training in the snake pit in Wigan, like genuinely in there. He's been over to the States and done some sort of training with Billy Robinson. And his kind of gimmick, as much as you can call it a gimmick, is he is 1970s World of Sport British wrestler.
Wow.
Right down to the fact he's like, even his sort of long socks that he wears on top of his boots, a 1970s British style. And it's kind of like, really, it's kind of this weird thing where by being just a straight-laced wrestler, he's able to stand out, and that's almost become a kind of a gimmick in itself.
Yeah, that actually is it sounds like something I immediately want to see. So I'm definitely going to check him out. But and I'm sorry to skip ahead. I just wanted to mention that because I wanted to get my cheap James Mason plug in because I really am high on him. But
I feel so old when James Mason is now sort of regularly referred to as kind of the veteran at the scene. He's like the guy you kind of go to if you want to find something out, or like he'd be able to tell you wrong. because I think the first time I saw him, he was probably about 15 or 16. He started when he was 14. And the first match I ever saw him was in a mixed tag with Klondike Kate, who we mentioned earlier. And the finish of the match was it was meant to be the men wrestling the men, women wrestling women. It kind of all broke down. Klondike Kate ran into the ring and did a splash on this like little James Mason and pinned him. And this was like the first kind of times I've been to All Star Wrestling, who were running venues regularly, so had kind of storylines building up feuds, as opposed to just one-off shows where like the stars came in one and you just sort of went home. And just the idea that you'd actually see a male wrestler was pinned by a woman, it was just absolutely mind-blowing.
I think he actually worked in Michinoku Pro years ago too for a little bit, but you know, he's a guy who I would love to see be a more well-known player. Well, I'll just put it that way. Dave, were you about to jump in?
Well, you'd mentioned the Snake Pit in Wigan. I was wondering what kind of reputation that has within the UK itself, because outside of there, it's portrayed as a pretty big deal. But I was wondering if that's more if it's well known within the UK wrestling scene at all.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of develops out of pretty much the kind of 20s and 30s, which was kind of, we were talking earlier about the sort of the missing gap between the when it was the music hall and when it was sort of revived later in the 30s as kind of a touring exhibition. And at that time, wrestling as it was kind of more of a competitive thing, that you would kind of have matches in gyms, and sort of what money you were making was people kind of betting on the outcomes. But that's always been kind of one of the training centres. And certainly for many years, you didn't necessarily have to be a shooter to be in wrestling, but you had to have some kind of amateur background. And you had a lot of guys who would actually have wrestled sort of several matches professionally before they were sort of formally told how the wrestling worked, which is quite an amazing skill to have, that you can work a match with a guy who doesn't know that the match has worked. A classic example of that, which is also worth looking out for on YouTube, was a show called The Big Time on BBC television in the early 80s, which was where every week sort of a member of the public would be taken and put into a particular world where they had never been before and had to be trained up and do a challenge at the end of it. So it'd be things like you'd be taught to be a chef and you'd have to cook a meal for a bunch of celebrities at the end of it. And one episode where they took a school teacher who wanted to become a wrestler, and he's kind of a school teacher, he's in the church choir for weekends, like the last guy to be in a wrestler. And it's just kind of amazing looking back on it, sort of as kind of a wrestling fan, sort of knowing how wrestling works, because he's taken with to a gym with Sid Cooper, and he has to try and take Sid Cooper down or do it, and Sid Cooper's like not doing anything, he's just standing there not going with the hold, and this guy's just completely out of breath trying to do him down, and they kind of train him up and they show him all the moves, and as it does genuinely appear that at no point is this guy like taught how wrestling actually works. So you're kind of teaching him how to, most of the training is teaching him how to fall, how to take the bump, sort of knowing he's going to end up taking a lot of bumps. He's taught how to post himself where he kind of gets whipped into the ropes. So you do the double steps, and you know, you turn around and take sort of a flat back bump into the ropes. And they kind of ask him, you know, why do you do that? It looks really weird. And it's been explained to him is you have to do that. Like, you have to intentionally turn around and do those, because otherwise you might fall between the ropes and really bad hurt yourself. And they come to select his opponent. And they, in the actual documentary, it's shown that the promoter, Max Crabtree, picks it. But apparently the actual story is that they came up with several names and photos and showed it to the producer of the show and said, like, who do you think it should go against? And obviously she just picked, you know, the kind of the least intimidating-looking guy, who's a guy called John Naylor, who was actually trained up in Wigan. And you're sort of watching this in dread, because they showed the entire match, which is at the Royal Albert Hall. And it's this match that, if you're not familiar with kind of wrestling and not sort of the behind the scenes kind of how it's put together stuff, it doesn't look that bad. But if you actually can see what's going on, it is just brutal. This guy is just taken apart. He's kind of skirt on that, and he's sort of carried to maybe about a 10-minute match or so, kind of given just about enough offense to look credible. And as far as I can tell, this guy is actually genuinely fighting, genuinely trying to win, and has no chance because the other guy is completely controlling him, and ends up kind of putting him in. I think he wins with like a sort of single leg Boston Crab, gets first submission, and then he's just unable to continue because he tries toughing it out. And as we've seen from sort of UFC matches, a lot of the time you come and show him wrestling, you go, oh my God, that looks so fake because you were putting a submission hold and you didn't give it up straight away. And we find out from UFC, actually, people can kind of withstand this, but it turns out to be a very bad idea in the long run. So this guy's carried up. And he's clearly just taken off to the hospital just in terrible shape. And like everyone's like, oh, you did. And I think they genuinely respect him because he really has given it a try. But yeah, if you're watching it from sort of, you know, a wrestling fan mindset, it's really not a pretty experience.
Go ahead, Dylan.
No, go ahead, Dave.
There's actually some brief training footage from the Snake Pit on YouTube as well, with a young Billy Robinson roughing up some trainees. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but Billy Riley's in it, so.
Yeah, Billy Riley's a guy who really doesn't get talked about that much anymore, oddly enough. I mean, he was a guy that I heard a lot more about years ago than I hear about now. I mean, I don't know if maybe I'm just not paying attention to people who are talking about him, but he seems like kind of a figure that is not discussed very much. I don't know if he's even a notable, treated as a notable figure by hardly anybody anymore.
I think partly that is because kind of particularly the Wigan scene was not necessarily training people to be pro wrestlers to be on television. It was more kind of giving you a grounding in sort of legitimate submission and grappling skills, and you use that as a basis to go into pro wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. I guess he was, you know, that sort of early, I don't know if you call it catch style or like your early practitioners of that. And it's interesting. I mean, reading Jonathan Snowden's book, Shooters, I was really, you know, this, obviously he talks about the Snake Pit some, but it's interesting how even a lot of the modern Japanese scene had a similar sort of like, we'll train you in the dojo first with legitimate holds. And then after the fact, you'll learn to be a real pro wrestler, which I think to a lot of Americans sounds totally insane. This idea like that you're going to go in and be beaten up, stretched, whatever, and then you're going to go train to do stuff that's not going to beat you up. But you know, ideally, I guess you do want somebody who's got at least athletic credentials and is tough enough to be able to take the heat to some degree. I don't know how that necessarily translates into big time wrestling anymore. But there may have been an era when it was useful. And to be fair, during the World of Sport era, I think having that credibility of being a guy who was really sharp and had what at least looked like technical prowess was certainly a big deal. And that was a big part of Kent Walton's calling the matches, was being able to point to those details and intricacies and backgrounds of these guys who were legitimately tough. Because let's be honest, not all of these guys look like the toughest guys in the world. Now, some of them do. But, I mean, Marty Jones, I'm a big Marty Jones fan. Marty Jones doesn't look like the toughest guy on earth. You know, he really doesn't. But he was a skilled wrestler, and he was a guy that was easy to put over if you were on commentary because of the fact that he was a skilled wrestler. Or at least that's my perception of him. But
I think one of the best examples of that is a guy called Mike Flash Jordan, who was a lightweight wrestler. He's got quite a famous match with Johnny Saint that was on World of Sport. And I think he's in some ways the perfect example of a British wrestler, because he is literally the most ordinary looking guy you can imagine. He works for his local council, his local authority during the day and wrestles on the weekend. And the only reason he's able to become a wrestler is just that he's got this particular skill at pro wrestling and can do something that ordinary people can't do. And it kind of really puts across the fact that a lot of the time in British wrestling, it was as much, they were built sort of as much as a skill as being sort of a pure athlete or pure, you know, really strong man. It was this kind of particular abilities he's got that without it, you know, could never have been a wrestler.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me pitch back a little bit because I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit more in detail about Jackie Paolo and Mick McManus, who I think both sort of go hand in hand for obvious reasons. We talked a little bit about the clip of their matches, but the match that was in the documentary. But you know, Mick McManus was inducted into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame this year. He was the first performer to be inducted from the British wrestling scene, unless you count Aserati, I suppose, who was, I believe, in the '96 class, but. He was the first guy who I think would be identifiable as a purely British performer in the sense that he's a representative of that style, so to speak, and what we've come to understand of that style. I don't know if you voted for him, John. I would assume you did, since you wrote the bio of his career that appeared in The Observer. But how do you – I mean, with McManus and Paolo, do they go so hand in hand that these are two guys who should both be in something like a Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, or can you separate one from the other? In other words, was McManus a much bigger star? Are these guys who sort of go hand in hand? And also, how important were they to British wrestling?
Yeah, I mean, they were absolutely the and anyone who kind of watched wrestling before the late 70s, Daddy era, they are by far the two biggest names. And they do go hand in hand in the same way that you have Daddy and Haystacks. And in terms of the Wrestling Observer, with like the specific criteria they have, probably McManus is a stronger candidate, partly because he had the longevity as a star, because Paolo left the TV screens and began promoting himself in the 70s. He was off television a lot more, so there's a lot less footage of him. And from as much as we see, McManus was probably more kind of a skilled in-ring performer. Paolo was kind of, you know, perfectly good, but tended more, was kind of based around the crowd interaction, kind of winding up the audience and kind of getting heat from the, whereas McManus was, you know, a very decent in-ring wrestler. So it's kind of that thing. I think in terms of looking at Paolo, I think he's a very strong candidate, but it's one of these cases where you don't want to just say McManus is in, so Paolo has to be in, because I think that's kind of a dangerous argument. It's particularly at the kind of point where you are at the Observer Hall of Fame at the moment with the number of people in it. It's kind of like you've got a pyramid and you're going down, and each tier has got more and more people in it. And it's kind of reaching the point now where you kind of have to wipe out saying so-and-so is in, so somebody else has to be in as well, because you kind of really open up the floodgates then.
Yeah, I agree with that argument, by the way. I don't like the idea that, well, this guy's better than the worst guy in, so we have to put him in. Like, I don't think that's a good argument as a rule. My point was more, is, you know, would British wrestling history, I mean, and here's maybe a better way of framing it. Jackie Paolo is a guy who obviously was the absolute right guy to feud with Mick McManus and to build these matches to, and to really, I guess, in some ways, kickstart the TV era in British wrestling. And could anybody other than Mr. TV have done that? I mean, that doesn't necessarily in and of itself make him a Hall of Famer, but setting that aside for a second, could anybody other than him have done that? Was he the literal perfect person for that role?
I think, yeah, and he certainly he had kind of an actual kind of cocky arrogance, and he made himself, and it was he was the guy who went and did that. And if everybody had done a Jackie Palo, then he wouldn't have stood out so much. I mean, he was considered outlandish because he put his hair into pigtails and put a velvet ribbon in it, and he'd wear stripy trunks instead of plain trunks, which, you know, in this era was considered absolutely outlandish, and it made him a television personality. But I'm certainly there was, you know, genuine skill there.
Yeah. And I agree with Dave that it was the hair.
The hair was just crazy. It was awesome.
Yeah, that was a good look. A good look for Jackie.
He really contrasted well with McManus, because McManus was this kind of guy who everybody absolutely hated, but I think there was kind of a grudging respect for, because you're kind of like, I really hate him, but he's kind of quite tough. Whereas Palo's like more of the kind of showmanship kind of guy, the guy I think probably more fans thought they could take Jackie Palo, whereas they wouldn't try to take McManus.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I was talking to somebody about McManus months ago. I mean, it may have been a year ago. And what I was told is that McManus, in a lot of ways, would be comparable to, in terms of fan perception, not in terms of how he worked, to like Harley Race in the United States. And the fact that people didn't really like him. I mean, he was a heel, but he was sort of their heel, and they respected him, and nobody would doubt for a second that McManus would beat the holy hell out of you if you were in any situation where that would come up. You would not want to test him, like you said. That's kind of, I guess, speaks to my buddy's recollection or his opinion that McManus is sort of comparable to Harley Race. Because when I think of American wrestlers who fit that mold of guys you wouldn't want to test and you know, heels that you begrudgingly respect, I think Harley Race is the first one that immediately comes to my mind. But you mentioned earlier some of the imports that came in to British wrestling with New Japan and others. How big of a deal was it? Did that have any effect on business? Because, I mean, you know, in the United States, when guys came in from other territories, you know, ideally it was good, it was meant to pop a house or to be a bigger deal. But with the way the British model worked, I mean, was it a big deal when you know, Sayama was there working as Sammy Lee or whatever his gimmick was, or when these other guys came in? Because I guess they came in earlier in their careers and they weren't known commodities. But were they?
Yeah, I mean, they would have to prove themselves, they could get over. It wouldn't necessarily, particularly in that era, British fans really didn't follow so much what was going on in the rest of the world, because you didn't have easy access to the magazines and sort of the different territories. So it wasn't so much this particular guy is coming in, you know, he's a big star, let's all pay the money to see him. It was more, it makes sense at any time that there will be wrestlers around the world coming here to, you know, take part and try and get on TV. But I mean, Siam is a classic case of a guy who gets over. I went to a show, it was about 1996, Michinoku came over here and did a couple of main events on a couple of all-star shows with the six-man tags. And it's like this great match. It was the typical Michinoku six-man. And so afterwards, we were kind of talking to kind of some long-time regulars and like going, it wasn't that a great match? And they're like, oh, it was great, but it was no Sammy Lee. And Sammy Lee had not been there for, you know, 15 years or so at this point, and still just absolutely remembered as the way he stood out.
That's funny because, you know, living in South Carolina where I live, Ric Flair is obviously huge, and you know, even with old time fans, when you hear them talk about guys, you hear them talk about Wahoo McDaniel, Johnny Weaver, Blackjack Mulligan, you're kind of your typical Mid-Atlantic staples. Those are the guys that get mentioned. But even with those fans, when you talk about wrestling that came in later eras, the guys that instantly get brought up inevitably in my talking to them, and I know, you know, Mike Mooneyham, who's the local columnist in town, you know, also a pretty well-known wrestling historian, will tell you the same thing. People always want to talk about Jushin Liger and the Great Muta because, like, when they were here, when they would appear, they felt like such revolutionary figures for their time. And so outside of the norm, that it was just almost hard to wrap your head around. And I mean, I still have friends. I tell this story all the time, but one of my best friends is a casual fan at best. And if you ask him to this day who the best wrestler he ever saw is, it's Jushin Liger. It's because we saw him live and he did, you know, all kinds of crazy things that you wouldn't have expected from a wrestler in 1992 in the United States. So, a guy like stands to reason that Sammy Lee would sort of have that sort of, he would sort of pop out of the picture, so to speak, as a memorable figure in British wrestling, as sort of your exotic memorable figure in British wrestling, I suppose, besides Adrian Street, of course. Dave, did you have something you were going to jump in with?
One question I did want to ask is, John, what kind of familiarity do you have with the movie Night in the City, and what do you think about its kind of depiction of British wrestling during circa 1950?
It's something I've seen. It's probably, I think, maybe based earlier than the film was actually made, because it's kind of looking at a more old-time thing. And if I remember rightly, it's kind of based on the idea that at this point wrestling is a genuine sport, but the promoter is trying to fix it, and this is somehow, you know, a very bad thing to be doing. So that's not necessarily a sort of top representation of kind of the position the business was in at the time. That's something that the documentary kind of oversimplified, may have given the wrong impression, because several people I've sort of spoken to who've watched it came away with the impression that they were trying to say wrestling was, you know, completely on the level until Joint Promotions was made. Whereas I think the point the documentary was trying to make is that Joint Promotions were doing a much more organised job of actually booking finishes to build up sort of long-term storylines and feuds and bring back business again, rather than it just being a kind of a one-off attraction.
Yeah. Well, one of the things with Night in the City is it's very much, it very much depicts, I think, warring promoters. And the other thing it kind of shows is Stanislaus Zbyszko is in it. And he basically kind of portrays the old school versus the new school clowns approach. So when people say that wrestling is not what it used to be, I mean, I point to that, you know, like, that's a time when 1950, when it was like guys were saying that it wasn't what it used to be, you know. So it's kind of an attitude that's always been around.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Wrestling Heritage website, the guys there who did a lot of work with the documentary and features in it, it's kind of strange thing back, because you think of old-time fans as, you know, sort of one you know, complete homogenous group of just like British wrestling in the old days. The kind of ethos of the Wrestling Heritage website is that they cover from 1952 up to 1977, which they sort of have as their cutoff date, because that's when the Big Daddy push starts. So it's kind of quite strange, and it's one of the, you know, the real sort of wonders of the internet of bringing people together, that you can kind of go on there and see fans who to them the glory days ended in the late 1970s, and the stuff after that they're not really so keen on. It's kind of great to be able to go on there, and in terms of not just looking back and looking at, you know, results and kind of what was on the TV, but getting the fans' memories of what it was like to follow wrestling at the time.
Yeah, there was a great, I really like the Wrestling Heritage site. I feel inclined to plug them too. There's a really great article, a kayfabe article written on Jim Brakes and Johnny Saint on that site that I really, really enjoy, sort of outlining their rivalry and its earlier manifestations, through when Brakes first won his first title, I think, in 63, and then I think the article was written in 71, but it's really interesting. It's good stuff. I'll post it in the link when we post this podcast, but I guess we have to mention them, because you sort of mentioned them there in passing, John. I don't think it's possible to discuss British wrestling without discussing Big Daddy, and you know, obviously a controversial figure, very much a reviled figure, I think, with a lot of people. And then there's other people who, in certain quarters, insist that he's not given the credit that he deserves for being a star. I am kind of an agnostic on whether Big Daddy is as big a historical figure as some people would have you believe, because I'm not from there, and I didn't experience him growing up, and I really don't have an accurate frame of reference. He's certainly not a very good in ring wrestler, to be very generous with my description. How important was Big Daddy to British wrestling? I mean, because I think there's a narrative out there that says the Big Daddy was the biggest star in wrestling in Great Britain, the biggest cultural figure. I kind of assume that is probably true, but I also don't know if it's true that business was sort of falling apart and then Big Daddy came into the fold and resurrected things, and then business died after he was on top too long. I don't know if that narrative is really accurate either.
I think it's very hard to kind of compare him with previous eras, because the Big Daddy era was in no way the business peak of the British wrestling. That was the pretty much the 60s and in the early 70s. In sheer terms of the number of shows, the number of full-time wrestlers who were going out there, the number of places where you could see wrestling every week. Big Daddy was a big star in a different way, but it completely changed the business model, because he was such a big star, everything had to be built around him. And he clearly cannot work 87 shows a week. He was genuinely working 300 dates a year. And he would generally sell out, because he was more of a novelty attraction. So he would appear in a town maybe once or twice a year. The only places he tended to appear more often were seaside venues, where you would have a different crowd every week, because it was holiday makers. Certainly business had been declining during the 70s, partly because the old joint promotion guys had kind of got out of the business through a kind of old age, and it was running down a bit. So it was like a shot in the arm to have Big Daddy, but it was changing business at the same time. At the same time, he was being pushed, drawing quite big crowds with the occasional sort of super crowd, the three Wembley Arena ones. In a kind of a wider context, the number of shows was rapidly declining. There were a lot of places that were having wrestling regularly were kind of now dropping it. And it was always going to be something that's kind of going to be short-lived in the big picture.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't get any feel for how relevant of a figure he was over the long haul. I think that's sort of the big thing with Big Daddy. You can point to him as a short-term phenomenon that you have to give him, or at very least his brother, a lot of credit for. But I don't really get the feeling that he was a long-haul performer. I mean, people say, well, yeah, people still know the name today in Great Britain. I mean, maybe that is true. I don't know. I don't live there. But there in the United States, a lot of people still know the name Haystacks Calhoun. I don't know that that really means anything. I guess he was a huge star.
An example of that, actually, he is generally very well known, particularly once you go over the age of maybe 30, 35, to people who were alive and can remember sort of the TV era before he was taken off. There's a game show over here called Pointless, where they go out and they ask 100 members of the public sort of a series of questions, and it's kind of a Family Feud in reverse, in that you've got to come up with a correct answer that as few people came up with as possible. And actually had a round recently where they had pictures of five wrestlers, and the sort of public had to try and name them, and you had to guess which ones they couldn't name. And I think it was Big Daddy, Kendo Nagasaki, The Rock, Andre the Giant, and Hulk Hogan. And Daddy was actually number one by a very long way. He was either 60 or 70 of 100 people recognised him, whereas something like only 8% of people recognised Andre the Giant. So, I mean, he does definitely have that public recognition. But in terms of the specific criteria for the Observer Hall of Fame, it's an absolute no, because you're talking about kind of ability in ring work rate, drawing power, and sort of historical importance. And he's kind of a strong candidate with an asterisk for drawing power, in that he was doing very well, but not in kind of the big venues that you sort of compare with the American guys. He was, you know, a strong candidate with an asterisk for historic importance, in that he was, you know, absolutely one of the biggest figures. But it does specifically say it has to be a positive influence, and in the long term, his sort of, not so much him, but his era was in no way a positive influence. It kind of led to the decline, sort of the loss of long-term fans. And then when you're talking about in-ring ability, I think it's almost the case that you don't so much just say he was a bad performer. He's virtually a non-performer in terms of comparisons, because in his last 16 years or so of his career, he probably had about 5 singles matches. He was a tag team wrestler. He was generally only in ring for a couple of minutes and doing nothing, which was partly through athletic ability, partly through age, and partly, this is a very good point somebody made quite recently, is because he was the cash cow, it made sense in a way. There was no point having him win more than he needed to be, because if he actually got injured in a match, they were completely screwed. But the rules, kind of the criteria, say you have to have something strong in every candidate or be so outstanding in the others that it doesn't matter. And when you look at it, he would be by far the worst worker in the Hall of Fame. And something really kind of put my mind to that is when I watched the Dusty Rhodes WWE compilation set, and you kind of think, oh yeah, Big Daddy's a bad wrestler, Dusty Rhodes is a bad wrestler. And you watch the Dusty Rhodes set, and then you watch you know, as many Big Daddy matches as you can stand, and it's just absolute light and day. So really, to qualify, he would have to be Hogan level drawing and, you know, Ricky Dozan level cultural importance, and he just certainly isn't. So I don't see how there's a serious argument for him going in, and unless you're misunderstanding the criteria.
I really see, after watching the documentary, that I would probably equate him a little more to Ultimate Warrior than to Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, certainly he was there for a longer period. Ultimate Warrior, when you look back, is just a remarkably short period on top. He was longer on top, and, you know, he wasn't considered a flop at the time, because he was kind of built as the top star, and, you know, people did want to be on the same show as him because he was going to sell out and you were going to get the best money. But it wasn't kind of, you know, a long-term boom period for the business. I mean, kind of, when you break down drawing power for the Observer Hall of Fame, I kind of break it down into questions of, you know, were you on top a lot? When you were on top, were you improving business? And, you know, were you on top a good time for business? And he's kind of, you know, across those three questions, he's kind of more limited.
Yeah, I think the thing with Big Daddy is, I don't think his run was long enough. Like, if he had been, you know, even as bad a worker as he was, and I think we all agree he's pretty terrible, but even as bad a worker as he was, if he had been a major drawing card for, say, 12 years, like a major drawing card for 12 to 15 years, I think it would be much harder to argue against him, because at that point you'd be talking about a guy who sort of lapped the field as a top draw in British wrestling history. But he really wasn't a top drawing card for 12 to 15 years, or at least that's not what I see in his candidacy. And if you don't have that, I don't know. I feel like you have to have something to that level to get in if you're as bad as Daddy was.
Yeah, I mean, that's really certainly the case. I mean, he's kind of it just doesn't have it in every category, and he's not so excessive as a drawing power and kind of historical importance, but it would make up for that. I mean, I think if he had been, you know, had wrestled singles matches and been, you know, not necessarily great, just, you know, decent ring, had okay matches, I think he's, you know, a borderline, but they discuss Warren's kind of strong candidate for getting him in under the criteria of the Hall of Fame, which is, you know, not to in any way downplay him as, you know, sort of a big figure, somebody who was kind of successful in his realm. And it really depends how you look on what the criteria of a Hall of Fame should be, because if you look at it literally as, you know, how famous was he within his kind of region, then he was very good. And, you know, some of the arguments on both sides from kind of the more outlandish, kind of exaggerated people are both silly on both sides. Kind of the people are saying, you know, he's got to be in, he was like this, you know, this top draw and everything, and it doesn't matter about his wrestling, you know, because he drew, it doesn't matter about his wrestling. But on the other side, I mean, some of the arguments, like, you know, why didn't he go to America, you know, and become a big star there? Well, yeah, it's probably because he was pushing 50 when he started becoming made into a major star, and, you know, was getting paid a decent living to go around. Why on earth? And that's true of, I think, a lot of the British candidates for Hall of Fame, because, you know, moving from Britain to go to wrestle in the United States or in Japan full time on a permanent basis, it's not the same as, you know, being a young guy moving down the coast from Portland to go and wrestle for San Francisco and then go and wrestle in Memphis. You're talking about moving to a different continent, leaving your family behind. And another factor with that is a lot of the British guys, because of kind of the limited exposure on TV and the way people got into it, were a lot older when they kind of became the TV stars. And Mick McManus has kind of only in the last couple of years admitted that he's been shaving quite a few years off his age for many years. So the match that was on the documentary there, which is the 1962, which is the first of the Mick McManus Jackie Palo feud that kind of went over the next sort of 13 years or so, he was 42 in that first match.
Wow.
So he's kind of becoming a big star in 40s and wrestling right through till he was you know, into his early 60s. So you know, there's no reason why a guy like that, with, you know, like a family and been living in this country for a long reason, is going to, you know, take a chance on flying over somewhere else, unless he's going to, you know, be guaranteed much better, you know, multi-million dollar contract, which obviously was not the case in the kind of time these guys were wrestling. It was, well, you'll come in, if you do well, you can make good money, but we're not promising anything.
Okay, this is going to be backtracking very, very slightly, but I want to ask this outright because we've talked about the Hall of Fame actually a little bit more than I thought we would, but I'm going to go ahead and throw this out here. How do you feel, and I'm not saying tell me whether you'd vote yes or no. You don't have to be that committal because I know that may be something you don't want to do, but how do you feel about guys like Brace and Saint? Because as workers, they're obviously outstanding, or at least I think it's pretty obvious they're outstanding. As TV stars, you know, Breaks, as you noted in your McManus bio, he was on TV an awful lot. I mean, there weren't very many guys who were on TV more often than him. So he was obviously perceived as a guy that ITV wanted on television for one reason or another. Are they outlandish candidates for something like the Observer Hall of Fame? Are they somebody that, you know, are seriously worth considering?
I think they're certainly worth considering. I think the difficulty with kind of guys like that who are not at the McManus level where you can, you know, absolutely say he was the top star for 15 years, here's a guy everybody remembers. The difficulty you have because of the British model is you don't have so many guys like in American territory where you can say, you know, Jerry Lawler was a big star in Memphis for so-and-so. Somebody else was a top star here for however many years. With the way the British system worked, you couldn't have a big star standing up anybody else, because to say you've got to have, 20 or more people who on their own are able to go and headline a show and be a, you know, credible main eventer that people are going to come along and pay. So you've got to have, you know, 20 top stars at the time. So it's very hard to stand out in the way that the Hall of Fame asked for. And, you know, in later years, when you change that model and try and push a big star, it had its effects elsewhere in the business because you couldn't run as many successful shows.
Yeah, it would sound like they had kind of an Eddie Guerrero type role in terms of they were just top-notch workers who were fairly successful.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty is once you start going with a great sort of saint is you do then very much open yourself up to there are as many people with, you know, a similar level of kind of skill and popularity and kind of drawing power and importance that you can say, well, they then should also be in it. And you just end up with, you know, far too many names. I think really the British voting over the next few years, the way that it works with the trying to get the certain percentage of people, I think it's going to take sort of a few years at a time, and one guy will kind of stand out and be the next one in. And then once he's in, it kind of clears the way for somebody else to then stand out. Because you can only really get in if it's something that sort of stands out amongst the group of possible candidates you can vote for within the particular category, which is, you know, Britain in Europe. So I think maybe it may well be a Jackie Palo at some point would be the next one in. And once he's in, somebody else might kind of emerge, even without, you know, say, an organised campaign or anything like that. I think that's more how it would kind of develop to people getting in.
Okay. I want to ask you also about Kendo Nagasaki. How big of a star was he on the British landscape? Obviously a very unique wrestler, even now, a very unique figure. How big of a star was he? How would he compare? Was he a guy who stood out entirely because of his gimmick? I mean, like, that's the impression I get, is that he's a guy who, not that he was bad in the ring, but that he was a guy who stood out entirely because of his gimmick. And I'm not even saying that's a positive or a negative, really. But how would he compare to the guys we've been talking about, Mark Rocco, Jim Breaks, Johnny Saint, even Big Daddy for that matter? How would he compare to those guys in terms of stardom and also as an overall talent?
Well, in terms of stardom, I would say he would most likely be top five. I think if you went and asked, you know, everybody in the country to name a group of wrestlers, I think overall there's a very good chance your top five would be McManus and Palo, Haystacks and Daddy, and then Kendo Nagasaki, just because of, you know, the memory of the gimmick of being the masked mystery man who nobody knew anything about. He was very good to very good in the ring, genuine skilled wrestler. Worked more of a heavyweight style, so it's kind of hard to compare him to a Breaks or a Rocco or that kind of style. But really, just amazing at keeping up the mystique. I mean, you have people to this day who insist that, you know, he never unmasked on television, or, you know, Big Daddy pulled up the thing and showed his mask and tried to do it, but he could never do it. Despite the fact, you know, there are now DVD releases in the shop of him having his unmasked ceremony, and also he wrestled one match without the mask. So it's just, you know, amazing how like ingrained into people's minds is. And also somebody who's been able to kind of keep the gimmick alive, you know, even all these years later would be, you know, he's done sort of lots of guest appearances on shows. He's been interviewed on chat shows, which is always great because he doesn't speak. So it just kind of turns into a bit of a running joke. And most wrestlers you speak to will tell you, you know, he turns up, he gets the dressing room to himself. You never speak to him, you never see him without his mask. And, you know, I don't know if that's true. I completely want to believe it's true. And, you know, if it's untrue, I don't want to hear otherwise, because it would spoil the illusion.
Yes. He has a great mystique. I mean, there's no question about that. When you talk about, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, kind of joking, but he is a guy who kind of has the mystique of an Undertaker, you know, like he has a similar sort of feel to him as a character. That would have stood out, I think, anywhere, but I think it probably stood out, especially during the period where he hit the scene in British wrestling. I think it stood out even more because of the era he came through, although that may be my cultural bias talking. But one other thing I want to ask you about, and I don't want to hold you hostage here all day, but I want to ask you about, there was the late 70s, when you had a lot of stars from joint promotions that jumped ship. They left, and they went. I think a lot of them went to All Star. I think Mighty John Quinn went. Might have been Johnny Saint too. A few others. Was this a case where the promotion was falling apart because the O-line promoters were retiring, as you alluded to earlier? Or was there something else? Was this a response to the initial wave of Big Daddy irritating people because of how he was being pushed? Or was it a combination of factors?
It's quite funny because everyone who kind of looked back on that era, you kind of look back and kind of saw how things happened, and you think it kind of makes sense that, you know, people, you say, you know, people didn't feel appreciated as a wrestler because Big Daddy was there, or, you know, they're being asked to lose on TV, or they weren't getting as much exposure. And every single guy you talk to who made the jump in kind of that era will just tell you, nope, because we're getting paid more. We're getting paid twice as much. Don't work for Brian Dixon. It's no problem. Which is hilarious to look back on in the later years, because you certainly don't think of Brian Dixon as, you know, a top paying promoter these days. You know, people often say, you know, you can make a living with him. He's pretty much the only promoter you can make a full time living from. And it is just about a living. You know, you get by day to day, and it's not what you make, it's what you don't spend. But yeah, I mean, everyone says it was just they went for purely for the fact that they were getting paid in some cases double the money. All you would lose is you would lose the TV exposure. So it's kind of, you had to weigh up, were you established enough that you could kind of go away without losing anything? You lose the, you've got paid X, not a great amount, but you got paid extra for the television matches. And it meant also you couldn't work for the Royal Albert Hall, which was your best paid show. But in the long haul, when you're talking about, you know, 20 or 30 dates a month, compared to being on your television once every couple of months or so, and occasionally headlining the Royal Albert Hall, the money just meant it made more sense to go to All-Star.
That's kind of funny to think that All-Star was sort of the equivalent of the WWF buying these guys. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah. But it was also, so was, you know, behind the scenes, it was paying the guys more. But also, I mean, to the fans, and this is, you know, another thing that seems very hard to believe to kind of people from the last 10, 15 years or so, is that among fans, they were the guys who had the action on the shows. It was, you know, not the Big Daddy. They had the likes of the Rocco. There was actually, when they started getting the occasional TV date, the final joint promotion show is actually a match that I put online the other day after William Regal asked if anybody had a copy of it. There's just absolutely horrendous six-man tag match with Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks, and it was a big comeuppance for a manager being managing guys against Big Daddy for all the years. And the next week you had the first All-Star show, and it had a Mark Rocco match. It had the debut of Jushin Liger, who's called Fuji Yamada at the time, and it had the main event, which was the return of Kendo Nagasaki to TV, which was a disco ladder match. Now, I can tell by the fact you're not responding to that, you've never seen it, because once you see it, you would never forget it, and those two words bring it. It's just a ladder match with a gold disc at the top with Nagasaki and Clive Myers. The only difference being it's filmed in a nightclub. You've got all the disco glitter pools going, all the disco lights are going, and they're playing a combination of disco music and Ride of the Valkyries during the whole thing. And Ken Walton is just trying to make sense of this. And it's like, it had to stand out, and it certainly stood out, and it was something you would never want to do again.
It would stand out, yeah.
No, see, I love to even hear that, because again, I think the perception that a lot of American fans and North American fans in general have of British wrestling is sort of your stodgy old grapplers getting in there and just exchanging holds for 36 minutes, you know, and that's not really true. But it's not really this either. But I like the idea that existed.
Yeah, I've said a few times, it's sort of a point that's worth stressing, is that a lot of the time the regular venues were running sort of weekly or fortnightly. There was a much more kind of action, more of a grudge match kind of thing, building up a feud with kind of people brawling, more blood, particularly depending on sort of what area of the country it was. So what you saw on television was not necessarily a representation of what the live events were like.
Yeah, yeah. And the TV was great anyway, in my opinion. But Dave, go ahead.
Well, I mean, TV represented, got over people as TV stars, but as far as getting over angles and stuff, were newspapers a big part of it?
It was, yeah, I mean, it was very much a local-based kind of thing. So, yeah, it would be, you'd have your posters, you'd just build it up in terms of, you know, come to a show, see an angle, come to the next one. Certainly anywhere that ran regularly. And then at the same time, you had a lot of sort of smaller towns who would maybe have a show once a month or so. And that was where the TV exposure really helped, because you would have, it would be based around the fact that a TV star was going to come wrestle there, which was kind of, it was a unique thing in sort of the much smaller towns. But you would see not just for wrestling, but you know, any kind of TV celebrity would come to your town, would be quite rare. It would only really be at Christmas, when you'd have the Christmas pantomime, you might get a celebrity there. And also the thing with wrestling is that a wrestler could come to your town and they would do the same thing and be the same person as they were on TV. Whereas if it was a soap opera star or sort of a TV actor, they would only come and they couldn't be the character. They, you know, come and maybe sing or, you know, turn on the Christmas lights or something like that. Whereas a wrestler, you were seeing the same thing you saw on television.
Yes, that's a good point, and one I hadn't really considered. But that's true. You actually get the experience of that character. I want to throw this out here real quick, too, because we haven't mentioned this. In American tape trading circles, tape trading seems like such a dated term now, doesn't it? But in American, I guess, smart fan circles, I think the matches that people often identify with the matches that sort of maybe got interest in the world of sport and British wrestling are the Clive Myers-Steve Gray matches. I think those are the matches that maybe not everybody would say that, but I think a lot of people would say that. I certainly know that I heard more about those, I want to say from their best matches at 75. I could be dead wrong on that, but I heard more about that series and that, you know, and those guys against each other than I did against, I knew who that series before I knew who Jim Breaks was, for example. And, you know, are those two guys who are well-known also, and is that series well-regarded in Britain, or is that just something that sort of caught on for a brief period within American wrestling fan culture and isn't really thought of that highly in Great Britain?
Yeah, I think it's the same kind of thing where it's more people looking back and kind of, you know, going, let's look and find, you know, what are the good matches, what are the not so good matches in there, as opposed to them being, you know, big stars at the time. They were again the kind of lightweight stars who would have the good match on TV, but kind of contrasted with the sort of the more grudge match or the more kind of heavyweights being built up. And again, they were kind of guys who could come and have a match sort of headline on a show when you're running a regular venue, but they weren't necessarily standing out as, you know, the absolute top line stars in terms of mainstream appeal.
Yeah. Yeah,
names, but people would necessarily, you know, the average person in the street would remember from that era.
Yeah, that's actually what I thought you would say, because that's kind of my perception, is that it's something that American fans sort of labeled as, like, you know, the best thing ever because it was maybe a gateway drug to a style. But, you know, after going back and watching a lot of their stuff myself, I mean, I like the matches, but there's plenty of matches that are just as good within that vein. I think it was just sort of a right place, right time thing, so to speak. Dave, do you have anything else?
Yeah, just two questions. I'll ask at the same time, and then if you could address both of them, John, that would be great. You mentioned in your article on House of Deception about Henry Urslinger. I was wondering if you could talk about his contributions to British wrestling. And then, if you have any thoughts about, you know, if there's anything now that's really worth checking out as far as, you know, good indie wrestling, and if you think there could be, at least at an indie level, some kind of resurgence within British wrestling.
Well, the Henry Urslinger and a guy called Saf Oakley, they were among the ones who kind of relaunched the business in the late 20s, early 30s as an arena attraction, with the idea that you would actually just go to an arena and pay to watch a wrestling show, as opposed to it being either, you know, something
I'll let you
that
know,
takes place.
So, John, the reason I the reason I ask about that too is because I've got done some writing about his promoting in the Maritimes a couple years later. So, anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. You see, it was just kind of presenting it as an arena attraction, and they also started the style of introducing submissions into matches, which both in terms of storyline and in reality, were the idea was adding submissions will make it a kind of a more exciting, fast paced style. In terms of stuff today, there's many British promotions doing good stuff, running venues regularly. So I say certainly if you're kind of a fan of the old British style, hunt out the Jack Gallagher matches and just see something that's in no way like World of Sports, but is in another way very cultural. It's the ICW. They have one of their shows is online. They have the entire show on YouTube. And it's got a match on there. It's called a Scottish World of Sport Rules match, which is exactly the same as the old World of Sport Rules. You've got the multiples and the rounds. The difference is that at the end of every round, you have to take a shot of whiskey.
Okay, that's tremendous.
But in fact, can see more of them. There's a documentary, I believe there's a website called vice.com. It's called The British Wrestler. It's about a guy who wrestles as Grado. And yeah, he's in no way not a great athlete. And his kind of a gimmick is just that he's a fan. And he kind of caught on as like a little cult hero there. And actually, it turns out he's a guy who's been on kind of wrestling fan forums over here for many years under like a different name. And it's just this great of how he, in this very, a few hundred people, becomes like this absolute kind of cult hero just because he loves wrestling so much, and it ends up sort of fighting for the title. So that's really fun watch. It's kind of the kind of thing you'd have to be a wrestling fan to kind of see the show, to kind of just appreciate this kind of weird thing of this guy just kind of making himself.
Yeah, I you've given us a lot of good random TV and or documentary snippets to go look up today, John. So I really appreciate that. That gives me something to do over my Christmas break when I'm bored. But I want to throw this out here real quick. I want to give you an opportunity. Is there any other performer or promoter or star of note that we haven't covered on the show today that you think is worth mentioning, even if it's just in passing? Because I don't want to skip over anybody that you think is worth mentioning. Obviously, we can't mention everyone, but is there anybody else of note that you think we've done a injustice by not discussing?
I think probably one guy you'd really have to mention would be Les Kellett, who was he was kind of a tough guy in real life, skilled wrestler, but he did this like weird comedy stuff in the ring. Very physical comedy, and there's a great match, Les Kellett against Leon Harris, who is actually an actor and a sort of voiceover guy called Brian Glover, and it's just a classic example of how you can sort of build this comedy into a match that has to be done in kind of a credible style because it's presented as a sports broadcast, and it is really sort of a great example of an aspect of the British business that it's kind of part of this kind of variety show. You'd have your violent matches, you'd have your hard sort of straight kind of heavyweight wrestling matches. You'd have your fast paced and lightweight stuff, and you'd also have the sort of comedy matches as well. And this is just a great example of that.
Yeah, guys like Kellett, who I think actually a friend of mine who's watched a ton of British wrestling is a big fan of his. But would those guys have had an influence on some of the more comedic aspects of, say, somebody like a William Regal? I'm thinking facial expressions and things like that. Would that be safe to say, or would that be a stretch?
I think it's partly that. I mean, he's spoken about sort of learning that, but also a lot of his the kind of comedy stuff he does is old working class British comedy in terms of like the timing and the delivery and kind of facial expressions, and also just reading a crowd. And I love when he talks about how he learns things. He says he's always trying to learn something that he can incorporate into his act to become more of a villain. And he'll just go out there in real world and he'll see a guy you know, an airport or something, but he sees, looks at him, thinks, oh, this guy really annoys me. Oh, what is it annoys me about this guy? How can I kind of bring this into it? I think, you know, certainly there's an element of the Jim Breaks in that as well.
Yeah, yes, yeah, absolutely. And Regal is, you know, I mean, we could do a whole show on Regal. He's another one of my all-time favorites and a great, 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 great wrestler, great talent. A guy I wish who would have been a bigger star than he was, although he was a star of note, and I don't want to undersell the contributions he's made to the wrestling business. But, John, I want to thank you for for being on the show. Honestly,
yeah,
I could probably talk to you for 5 hours about British wrestling and not get sick of it. You know, anytime you want to come back and do a similarly themed show or go into more detail about one of these guys or even something totally different, because I know you've written about wrestling from just about every possible angle, I think it's I'm safe in speaking for myself and Dave in saying that we'd love to have you back on in the future. And I would also like to give you an opportunity to plug anything you've got coming out, whether it be in Fighting Spirit magazine or whether it be book, another article, et cetera, et cetera. So here's your shot to chill real quick.
Well, we've already covered the three books. I'd say certainly if you've got a Kindle, check out the Greetings Grapple Fans, because that covers a lot of the kind of stuff we've talked about here. And also, say, we do now do a monthly piece in Fighting Spirit magazine where we sort of cover world sports era wrestlers' career where possible. If they're sort of still alive, we try to interview them, get some sort of great stories about kind of the behind the scenes stuff and everything. And that's it's available in the shops in Britain here. But if you've got an iPad or an Android tablet, then you can actually buy a Fighting Spirit magazine app. And with that, you can either buy individual individual issues and sort of look at them on screen, sort of very well designed, or you can take out a subscription. And the way the subscription works is you pay for a certain number of issues and get a discount, but you can choose which ones you get. So you can go through and get back issues, or you can sort of take a look each month, see if you like the look of an issue, and if you don't, you can just sort of skip it and sort of roll over your subscription. So that's definitely well worth looking at. It's sort of new sound magazines. It's kind of aimed at some of our mainstream audience. It covers WWE, TNA, but we have a lot of coverage, different stuff, kind of almost kind of sort of newspaper quality writing, but with kind of the old fanzine style, a really good fanzine style of article on all different subjects. We also have a lot of kind of historical stuff. I mean, we do a lot of pieces, but we kind of run anniversary stuff. So most of this year, I've been FSM's 1992 correspondent, because I'm the only one who can just, you know, write a lot of this, just move up looking it from memory. But definitely well worth checking out, and, you know, not just something that you'd only be interested in if you're based here in Britain.
Yeah, and I will vouch for that app. I actually downloaded it a couple of days ago to the iPad. It's very, very sharp. And Brian Elliott has done a wonderful job with Fighting Spirit. If you're somebody who is looking for a slightly different spin on wrestling media, but one that is accessible and entertaining and very, very broad in its scope, I would highly recommend it. I don't think that's an exaggeration or me being hyperbolic, as I'm often accused of being when I say it's very, very, very good. And it's also, you know, it's a magazine that's published some of my other comrades in arms. So on that front, I have a vested interest in touting it as well. But John, again, thanks so much for coming on. I will repeatedly say this, but anytime you want to come on and do another show in the future, just let us know, and we'll have you on again.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Love to do it. Thanks for having me.
All right, gentlemen, have a good good evening, good afternoon. In John's case, Dave, have a good rest of the day. And everybody who's listening, if we don't talk to you again before Christmas, and there's a good chance we probably won't.
I go to Nova Scotia on Friday, so I'm pretty out.
have a merry Christmas, and we will talk to you, or talk at you, I guess, very soon. Probably next up, I would guess, would be maybe a year-end show of some sort. So everyone, have a good holiday season. Bye now.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.